This is The Think Tank, talking about the major political, economic, and social issues of the week. With Dr. Mike O'Neill and hosted by Mike Russell. KTAR News on 92.3 FM and KTAR.com. The Think Tank.
Okay, Mike O'Neill here today. We're talking politics once again, big surprise, with Luigi Del Porto, legislative reporter for the Arizona Capital Times, and Rebecca Sanders, ace congressional reporter for the Arizona Republic. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
One of the most shocking developments, I think, of the whole campaign is a Sanders win in Michigan. By the way, it's also the biggest egg in the face example of the polling industry. And I think there's going to be more, and we'll talk about that later. But there was no poll that showed anything less than a Hillary Clinton 20% lead. And so a Sanders win by any amount is shocking. And the question is, do you think it's game changing?
That's definitely going to have to be seen as we see more contests coming up. But it was a huge loss for Hillary and a big surprise to everybody. And what those polls missed, it seems like, is that enthusiasm gap among Sanders supporters, that they're really excited and they're coming out to rallies and in this case to vote for him. We'll see if that continues. He's still behind in the delegate count, so he'll have to make that up if he hopes to win the nomination. But for Clinton, it's definitely a moment of reckoning where she has to figure out what she needs to redouble her efforts on going forward.
And she does need to redouble her efforts, and especially in getting young folks, white middle class voters, and what this shows you is that, you know, Sanders has some pull, and if he can continue this, it will be a long fight in the Democratic nomination before we actually see a winner.
And one of the key constituencies that did not come out for Clinton to the point that she expected in Michigan was African-American voters. And that's been a big theme of this campaign, that she's touting her support among African-Americans, and yet the turnout wasn't as high as she was hoping for. So we'll have to see if that continues going forward.
And Sanders had to do better in the African-American community to win Michigan. To me, the question is, can he replicate that in the other big industrial states? But you made an interesting observation about enthusiasm, and that's been one of the most notable things of the whole campaign. I have a mental picture of the convention. And let me start with the presumption that Hillary is still going to be the nominee, which is, I think, the odds on, not a certainty, but it's the odds on favorite at this point, notwithstanding Michigan. But I see an inevitable Bernie Sanders night with massive enthusiasm. And then I think the question will be on the night of the nomination, when Hillary accepts the nomination, will the enthusiasm level match that had been given to Bernie Sanders? And if it's conspicuously different, everybody will comment on that.
And it's definitely a question of, will Bernie Sanders supporters be willing to switch over to Clinton if she wins the nomination? Or is there a risk of them sitting out or even potentially going for another somewhat anti-establishment candidate such as Trump? Is that even possible?
And that really is a challenge for the Democratic Party, which is to start the healing as soon as we see a clear winner, to immediately start going to Sanders and say, look, we need your support. What can you do to help out? And of course, they have to be, the Democrats have to be unified. They can't do the same playbook that Republicans seem to be doing right now if they want to win the White House again.
So it seems to me, doesn't it seem to you, that the problem that the Republicans have in that area is way worse than the Democrats? That it's far more likely the Bernie people will sign up with Hillary than the kind of fracture that we're seeing?
This cycle is so unpredictable. Yeah. I don't even know how to answer that question. I mean, it's one of the arguments I've been seeing lately is this question of, if the Republican primary was not so fractured and kind of so all over the place, would there be more attention being paid to the rift among Democratic voters for Sanders and for Clinton? And I think that's very likely that we're not hearing so much about the really divergent groups in the Democratic primary, just because there's so much oxygen being spent on the Republican primary.
And I do think that the Republican Party is more fractured than the Democratic Party. I think, you know, national pundits are talking about not just the split in the party, but questions about, you know, what is to be Republican? What does that mean in the age of Donald Trump? I mean, there, what we're seeing right now are conservatives flocking to Ted Cruz and saying, look, he is the guy to beat Trump. And then sort of other establishment Republicans hoping that maybe John Kasich could continue and do some good showing in some states and maybe potentially have a contentious convention night. And some are saying maybe John Kasich's their best hope of maybe, you know, ensuring that we do have someone that could win the White House. Of course, the thinking there is if Donald Trump wins the Republican nomination, you know, he might have a harder time getting the voters that Hillary Clinton would, for example, Hispanic voters, you know, African-American voters, the minorities, et cetera. Of course, Rebecca's right. This election has been so unpredictable. So who knows how the voters will actually react and vote come general election.
It's so stunning to me that the hope now among the Republican establishment is, well, maybe Kasich will make it, when it's like, okay, first it was Jeb Bush, now he's out, you know, then it was Rubio, now there's serious doubts there, you know, now it's Kasich, and it seems like there's just cycling through. Oh, well, maybe he'll break through,
they're hoping that he'll win Ohio, which is, I think, winner take all, and that will at least stage thing. One thing I want to ask about in this relation, Arizona endorsements. You see, Trump has picked up what I would call the old SB 1070 crowd, you know, Brewer, Arpaio. And maybe even more staggering, we're talking about splits. The last presidential nominee, Mitt Romney, has said, in effect, if Trump gets a nomination, I don't support him.
Right. Yeah. You're seeing a lot of splits here in Arizona among high profile Republicans. You know, you had Congressman Trent Franks very strongly saying Trump cannot be our nominee and calling on Rubio and Cruz in some kind of odd collaboration to team up against Trump. And yet you've got Brewer and Arpaio and some others going for Trump. So I think it kind of mirrors the way that you're seeing the primaries go, that it's all over the map, which, you know, these candidates winning different states, and even here in Arizona, it's pretty fractured. But it seems from the very limited polling that we've been seeing in Arizona that Trump really is a voter favorite. What's interesting is I was looking at the fundraising reports recently, and Trump has received very little money from donors in Arizona, which mirrors what's been happening nationally. He's just not needing money.
He hasn't needed money.
But Rubio is the number one
for money
fundraiser in Arizona, and yet he's pretty...
Well, we'll talk about some Arizona races and other things, that Arizona congressional and Senate races, when we return in the think tank. This is KTAR News, 93 FM.
The Think Tank, KTAR News on 92.3 FM and KTAR.com.
We are back in the Think Tank with Rebecca Sanders, Arizona Republic reporter, and Luigi Del Puerto, legislative reporter for the Arizona Capital Times. I want to talk about Arizona electoral politics. Number one, U.S. Senate race. A tidbit that I want to start out with, the only poll that I'd seen, shows two things. John McCain looks like he has minimal opposition in the form of Kelly Ward for the nomination, but that same poll showed a near dead heat with Ann Kirkpatrick for the general election, suggesting he might be in some trouble. Do you believe that?
Well, even McCain himself has said that he expects a tough race with Ann Kirkpatrick, and that he's not taking for granted a re-election. So, and you know, Kirkpatrick has been touting a variety of polls showing a competitive race. This is so early in the cycle. I'm always skeptical of polling. this early, but I you know, she's a strong candidate, and I think that she has a lot of things going for her.
Yeah, Ann Kirkpatrick's a very good retail politician. This is a lady who's won CD1 a couple times despite very stiff opposition from Republicans.
And so, it's a swing seat.
Yes, it's a swing. CD1 is a swing district. It's a very huge district. And you have to be a very good retail politician to get the votes that you need, the coalition that you need to win in that race. And so she's shown that she can raise some money, not as much as John McCain, but she's been able to raise some money. I think it will be a very good fight this November.
The McCain position on Trump seemed to be somewhat more muted than the Romney position.
Yeah, I mean, I think he's in a tough spot here, right? Because if Arizona goes strongly for Trump, he doesn't want to be on the wrong side of that.
And he's facing a primary opponent from the far right.
Right, absolutely. But at the same time, I think his inclination is to, he's supported Lindsey Graham and has seemed supportive of some of the other more moderate Republicans for the presidential race. And so I just think that he's trying to kind of tread a fine line here of not pissing off the far right, but also
The far, far right already despises him.
That's true.
Those folks are gone. The question is the almost far right.
Right.
Right. I mean, this is a party that has censured John McCain at the county party level, at the state level. There are folks that, for one reason or other, simply hate John McCain. They will not vote for him regardless.
I don't know. You think? I don't know. The real far right, I mean, they will vote against him in the primary, but don't you think they generally return? Because they're not going to vote for a Democrat and they're not going to want to see a Democrat
unless
win.
They just skip that part of the ballot.
Right. And you mentioned that John McCain's position on Trump has been muted. I think that is an understatement. I think there's some dissonance there that I'm seeing from him. Donald Trump belittled him, mocked him, mocked his war record.
Incredible. I thought that was the first thing I saw that Trump said that I said, that's over the line. There is no way he will survive that. And I and everybody else was wrong.
Right. And you were not alone. A lot of people thought, no, you can't go after a war hero like John McCain, mocked his record, mock his being captured and still do well when he's defied all expectations to begin with. But John McCain, he has said a couple times that he will support whoever is the Republican nominee.
Which is, of course, when you use that language, that is so deliberately kind of like understated. It sort of says, I'm holding my nose. I don't like it, but I'm a good Republican. I will always follow the damning with faint praise kind of thing. That's right. The kind of language that we heard about Goldwater in 64, about McGovern in 72, when each case there were significant elements in each respective party that really were adamantly opposed, but they were going to, so they made some very pro forma statement, which it didn't take a whole lot of sophistication to read between the lines, saying this is a pro forma endorsement that they're making because they feel they have to make. What was conspicuous to me was Romney didn't do that.
Right.
If you watch that Romney speech, it was forceful and it was damning.
Yeah, he called Romney.
But he's
called,
also not running.
Yes.
Right.
Are you sure about that?
Well, at least at this point.
At this point, yeah. There's been some talk of maybe a third party candidate, and it's been on and off. Talk has been on and off now for months. But see, John McCain, the day before said and reaffirmed his commitment to vote for whoever is the Republican nominee. The very next day, Mitt Romney went on that big speech and called Trump, phony and a fraud. And John McCain sent out a statement saying, we have to listen to our leaders like Mitt Romney. And I do agree with Mitt Romney on certain things. So clearly he's, he's trying his best to leave room for some form of unity or some form of healing, maybe after the Republican primary. But like everybody else, I think there's some, he's conflicted. A lot of Republicans are conflicted about what to do publicly, at least.
But what's so amazing here is, I mean, clearly Romney is kind of seeing his role as needing to step into the Republican primary to bring some sense to it. But he slams Trump, but then he doesn't come out in support of any of the other candidates. And so he just leaves the field basically where it was before, having tried to beat up on Trump. And I don't see really a whole lot of difference that that speech made.
And real quickly, yeah. I want to move off of that because we're approaching a break. Two congressional districts. One is CD1 and Kirkpatrick's district, mostly northeastern Arizona. Who do you like in that race?
This is a crowded race. I think we've got 11 candidates now on both sides of the aisle and an independent. But the GOP primary is the really crazy one going on. We've got the State House Speaker, David Gowen, running, Pinal County Sheriff Paul Babiou, former Secretary of State Ken Bennett. We recently had an announcement from Carlisle Begay, a state lawmaker who's Navajo, who, if he were to win, could become the first Navajo in Congress, and a variety of others.
The interesting story about him is that he is a recent Republican flip from a Democrat.
Yeah, 3 months ago is when he switched over. So
that was a head scratcher.
Is it a head scratcher? I mean, I think for Republicans, there's a huge incentive to show that they're diversifying the party and that they've got someone iconic like him representing them.
Oh, I understand why they'd love to have him. I don't understand why he was willing to move.
Well, he's got so much more at his disposal, I think.
Not a whole lot of people were actually surprised when he switched to Republican because he had voted for a Republican budget before. Some had speculated that he's in fact very close to Andy Biggs, for example. He lived in Gilbert or was in Gilbert, although officially he lives in CD1 in Ganado.
Well, we will pick this up and we will talk about the remaining congressional district that's at up for grabs after the break. You're in the Think Tank, KTAR 92.3 FM.
The Think Tank, KTAR News on 92.3 FM and KTAR.com.
We are back in the Think Tank with Luigi Del Puerto, legislative reporter, Arizona Capital Times, Rebecca Sanders, congressional reporter, Arizona Republic. And joining us in a few minutes is John Gilliland, who will talk about some of the things that are going on in the Arizona State Legislature. But before we go to that, we had a little bit of unfinished business here. The other congressional seat. Now, we've got let me just set this up a little bit. We have, as I've always said, there's 9 seats. There's 3 that have been regarded as competitive. And we talked about one of those, that's CD1. The other 2 previously competitive races were CD2 and CD9.
Currently snoozers.
Yeah, exactly. And it's interesting. And the reason I lumped those together is we have those are in terms of the population, they're very competitive. But it shows, I think, the advantages of incumbency. A Republican, Martha McSally, in southern Arizona. A Democrat, Kyrsten Sinema, in central Phoenix, Tempe. Both seem to have scared away all the serious opposition. Maybe it's the piles of money sitting in their bank accounts.
Certainly. Both have done very good jobs in Congress in terms of representing the district and sort of straddling that sort of middle line, particularly in the case of Kyrsten Sinema. But also both are just very good fundraisers. I mean, McSally has raised more than $1 million. Sinema's raised a lot more. And, you know, when you're facing incumbents who have a ton of money, a big war chest, I mean, it's really hard to go toe-to-toe with those kinds of candidates.
You know, the other thing about this, I've noticed there have been occasionally, very interesting, we've got like 5 Republicans, 4 Democrats in the congressional delegation. I have seen votes come down where the 3 swing district people voted on one side and all the partisan districts voted on the other. We have one other interesting development. That is Matt Salmon's district. That is safe Republican. So the real action there is in the Republican primary. What do you see going on there?
Right. So this is District 5, which is most of the East Valley.
From Mesa, not Tempe, but Mesa,
right.
Mesa Gilbert.
Gilbert, Chandler, mm-hmm. Some Queen Creek. Sure. So this is still shaking out. He only announced his retirement about 2 weeks ago. And the only 2 candidates we have now, both conservatives, both from the state legislature. That is Senate President Andy Biggs, who came out basically with a prearranged support from Salmon. Salmon announced his retirement and said, Andy Biggs is my guy. I'm going to really support him to replace me. And then you've got State Representative Justin Olson, who is a little bit younger, a little bit less experienced in the legislature. Still very conservative credentials, both of them, but he's kind of running as this, well, I'm the outsider, I'm not the establishment pick, which is kind of funny because you're thinking like establishment usually means moderate. Not in this case. No. It's more about just kind of the insiders at the Capitol. Mm-hmm. But it's also a little ironic because Olson was running for House Speaker and had lined up all this support in the Capitol from insiders. So it's a little bit
creates a vacancy there,
subtle,
to be sure.
Right.
I think the real question in that race is whether somebody who is in fact from the establishment camp of the Republican Party, somebody like Scott Smith, for example, if he joins the race. Last time we spoke with him, he was inclined not to. He said, you know, I'm interim chief of Metro Valley Metro, and the indication there is he might in fact stay in that job. However, there was a poll done recently by a new firm, and that poll showed that if there was a head-to-head match between Andy Biggs and Scott Smith, that Scott Smith would win by 7 points. Of course, it's very early in the race. He hasn't even jumped into the race. I think that poll is mostly a result of name ID. I mean, Scott Smith's more known than Andy Biggs or Justin Olson. He's run a governor's race in the past, and he's former mayor of Mesa, very popular mayor of Mesa.
And people know who their mayor is. They don't know who their legislator is.
Right. And I think an important indicator here is that there are a variety of other more moderate Republicans who were considered as possible candidates in this race that have passed, for instance, Worsley. So there doesn't seem to be a huge appetite to take this race on, probably because the voters in that district are pretty conservative.
Okay, we're going to move to the state legislature, as promised. We're going to talk about, bring John Gilliland on the phone. What's the story with tax credits and private school vouchers?
Well, the legislature's been looking at ways in which they can expand the program to encompass all Arizona students. I believe by the year 2020, They're looking at expanding that program, and there are calls. There's talk that by expanding that, there might be a way to reduce some of the tax credits that have drained, you know, Arizona coffers tens of millions of dollars over the years with the one-for-one tax credit that people can donate to schools.
Rebecca, your folks at the paper have been working on this issue,
right? So we've analyzed the impact that the tax credits have on the state budget, as well as what the private school vouchers, what students they benefit the most, and brought to light, interestingly, information that it seems like no one has looked at before, even in the legislature, which you would think would be necessary for informing their votes. But for instance, just with tax credits in general, and this includes everything from for private schools or for, renewable energy projects. This is taking a huge chunk out of the general fund to the tune of $400 million a year. And it's really hampering the legislature's ability to have these funds to appropriate how they wish. In terms of the private school vouchers, this is basically money, tax money, that families can choose to take to offset the cost of sending their student from a public school to a private school. And the argument often is, well, this helps special needs kids. This helps kids in low-income areas that are going to a failing school go to a better private school. And yet our analysis showed that the majority of these funds are going to kids who would otherwise be going to the wealthier, higher performing districts, and it's gutting those schools.
There is a bill in the state legislature that would expand the voucher program. Rebecca mentioned it used to be for special needs students. It's been expanded to include other groups of students, but still a very small pool
of
pupils.
Yeah, I think that we're going from, just to put it in perspective, there's what, a 1,000, 1,500 cap on it now, and this would take the cap off. It could be a million kids.
Right. It would include everybody. It would allow anybody.
This is the difference between a pilot program that's a relatively modest thing and something that could, frankly, devastate public schools.
Well, that's what public school advocates are saying, that you can't just have a program that allows anybody to go and to take 90% of the per pupil spending by the state and then go to a private school, a parochial school, or do homeschooling. However, that bill doesn't seem to be going anywhere. It's been having a really hard time getting out of the House. I don't see that bill actually getting out of the House this year. And the thing about that bill is, as you mentioned, is that it's such a significant bill in the sense that it's so huge, it's so big, and it's so fast, if you will.
Right, and kind of an interesting wrinkle here is we've just been talking about Justin Olson jumping into the 5th District Congressional race. He's been pushing this ESA expansion, and he argues, well, I send my kids to public schools. I'm not using this tax credit. I don't expect everyone to use this tax credit. It's just there to help anyone who feels like they need, you know, an alternative school to go to be able to do so.
Yeah, I think part of the criticism is one of the main effects, if you open it up to everybody, the private school tax, is all the generally wealthier parents who are sending their kids to private school already.
Get a nice little tax break.
Get a huge cut at the expense of the public school. And say you're running a public school with 500 kids in it. All of a sudden, I mean, it's a significant bite into an allocation for public schools that is already, 49th out of 50? You know, I wonder do you think this will have an impact on the referenda for 1-2-3? Which I should explain what that is as well.
Sure. So that is definitely a fear of the proponents of Prop 1-2-3. And this is the proposition that comes out of a deal that was struck between the governor and schools to settle a lawsuit saying we are going to use the state land trust and other means to raise more money for the schools, but we need voter approval to do this. And the fear among proponents of this vote is that you're sending a mixed message. You're saying, let's give more public taxpayer money to schools, but then let's take money, public money, out of the public school system for private school vouchers.
So you look at the whole impact of that and say, I like 1-2-3 because I see our schools have been shortchanged, but all you're doing is providing a little bit more money. Then you're going to money for the public schools. Then you're going to turn around and take all of that out. And so does 1-2-3 end up being a funding mechanism for private schools? Interesting question. And we've dwelled on this one, but it's an important one. It's one of the biggest pieces of the budget. We will go through a litany of other items that are before the Arizona legislature when we return in the think tank. This is KTAR 92.3. We'll be back in a moment.
The Think Tank, KTAR News on 92.3 FM and KTAR.com.
Okay, we're back in the think tank. John Gilliland, we ask you a question or two about some other things in the legislature. One is House Bill 2023. That basically says that you can't bring somebody else's ballot into the polling place.
That's right. And in fact, it's not the legislature anymore. The governor's already signed it into law. And it makes it a felony, in fact, to do that if you're not a relative or a caregiver of the person who's voting. And the rationale for that was to establish a secure chain of custody between the voter and the ballot box. It sounds like something off of CSI, really. But there are people, though, that opposed it that are afraid that by limiting the ways in which these ballots can be submitted, that you're actually suppressing lower-income and disadvantaged voters.
Is this affixed to is there anybody documented any abuse in this area?
No, there's not. We've asked county election officials several times over the last couple of years. This is not the first time this bill has actually been passed and signed into law. We've asked county election officials whether there's been any concrete evidence of, you know, fraud related ballot harvesting. The answer is no.
Then I gotta, if there's no example of documented fraud in this area, then I gotta say, look at what's going on. This has been a common practice, particularly in minority communities, And you got to wonder if this is really an attempt to suppress or make it more difficult of those groups who traditionally use that.
Those groups are certainly saying that that is the reason for this bill. They're saying that this has been a tool that's been used by folks who don't have cars, for example, who have elderly people in the houses, and they need somebody just carrying the ballots to the precinct places.
Regardless, that one's law. That's a done deal. Okay, Senate Bill 1516, campaign finance restrictions. What's that going to do?
That is a massive bill. It does a lot of stuff. But the upshot, basically, is it's raising the threshold of contributions under the campaign finance requirements from $500 to $1,000, so it's doubling that. The limits would remain the same, but nothing would stop a committee from accepting even more than that. And opponents are saying that this is going to result in a big lawsuit. It had no bipartisan input. And it's really almost a gift to dark money groups.
Interesting. Kind of opposite the trend, I think, of most public opinion that thinks dark money is a big problem. There was a newspaper lead story the other day about part of this, and I think it was the same bill, and correct me if I have it wrong, that they would basically say the regulation of these groups is restricted to whatever the IRS has said is okay?
Right. There's a provision in this bill that essentially says you can spend as much money as you want. There are limits to how much you can spend if you are a nonprofit based on IRS rules. So basically, it has to be your primary spending has to be on charitable contribution, etc.
If you are a charitable organization can spend up to 49% on politics, but if you're not prohibited from spending more than that, but you can't call yourself a charity.
Right. So what this bill does is that it says, okay, based on IRS rules, if you've not been dinged by the IRS, if you're in good standing with the IRS, if your tax exempt status has not been revoked, then the state will basically say, well, you can spend as much on ballot measures, and that's fine with us. And that is a big change, because right now we count ballot measure spending as election rating spending. This proposed law will say that's okay, you can spend as much there as well.
I think I see the evasion, and it's an obvious one. You set up this phony organization and you have it spend 51% of its funds on, quote, public education, which basically means lobbying on issues, but not making an explicit endorsement for a candidate, and then it funnels the other 49% to candidates of its choice. And under this, that sounds to me like that would be perfectly legal.
And this has been an ongoing problem for a number of years now. You do have these groups that sprout every election year with innocuous-sounding names like Good Governance, Arizona, whatever, and they spend on either ballot measures or candidate spending. And the Secretary of State's office actually saying that their proposed legislation would ensure that this does not go on. We'll just have to see. This is such a massive bill, a huge change. It's like last time I looked, it was like more than 50 pages. And so we are going to see the effects of this bill. But we're not sure exactly how this will play out in the elections.
Well, there's going to be an initiative on the ballot, I'm fairly certain, the Dark Money Initiative, which kind of goes in the other direction, would seem to, if this passed, would seem to possibly supersede it.
Right. That was a constitutional amendment. Mm-hmm. And what it does is it includes a whole lot of reporting requirements for so-called dark money groups. A constitutional amendment, however, does not apply to ballot measures. And what we're talking about in this particular instance is ballot measure spending. So I guess the upshot is that we'll see how this will all play out, assuming, for example, that the Dark Money Initiative passes this November as well.
Back to the specific issue of these dark money groups saying, well, we're spending 51% of our budget on educational and issue advocacy. I mean, that is one of the biggest canards in campaign finance.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, this is...
It's not education in the sense of K-12 reading, writing, and arithmetic.
That's right. I mean, these are... We've at the Republic basically shown an issue ad versus a campaign ad. And the issue ad doesn't say vote for or against,
right,
but it's just as scary-sounding...
Take out the line at the bottom said, and therefore vote for Joe Slobotnik.
It's just as big of a... an attack ad as any of the others, and yet they're able to claim it as, well, we're just educating the public on a certain issue.
Or write Senator so-and-so and tell him to, you know, da-da, which is really an attack ad, but it's under the guise of public education. So, you know, the first thing you see with any of these, any requirements at all with respect to how you run campaigns is the lawyers come in and figure out how you can best evade it. And so if you have a law that's written by somebody who really doesn't want to have an effect, it's very easy to write legislation that purports to regulate something but really leaves a loophole.
But it's also making a lot of these contributions far more fungible, though. It's permitting candidates to divert money given to their campaigns to help others get elected. So if you've already got a big war chest, you can start funneling money to people that maybe you want to give a leg up to. And then it's also allowing for unlimited spending by outside groups on social media sites with no requirement to disclose who it is that's financing it.
So it's really kind of a pro-dark money, anti-disclosure bill.
It's a big wet kiss.
Okay, SB 1257 passes the Senate, would allow concealed carry in government buildings.
It would indeed, and even those government buildings and other facilities where there are signs explicitly saying that you can't bring your weapon in. And their opponents have had a problem with it, saying that it provides an onerous financial burden on these facilities to have to provide the different locked facilities for these guns and other weapons that people would bring in, but now for metal detectors and whatnot to detect the guns coming in. But supporters of the measure like John Kavanaugh say, well, there's no financial burden. Just let them in with their guns. You don't need all that other equipment. Just let them in.
You have to see that one passing the House?
It's hard to say. It is a Republican House, so it could very well pass.
Another interesting one, the HB 2617, you know what that is?
HB 2617.
Boycotting Israel?
Bill.
No,
that's the Israel bill, yes. That's a very interesting one in that it would require any business doing business with the state of Arizona to certify that they are in no way not doing business with Israel or involved in any divestment types of efforts against Israel. Supposedly something that would support Israel. Opponents say that it really does nothing more than...
Thank you all. We're out of time. We're in the think tank. By the way, if you want to catch this or any other issue, it is on my website, mikeoneal.org. And everything up to and including last week is up and revised. We'll see you next week in the think tank, 92.3 FM.